So just some facts about World War I. World War I began on July 28, 1914, and lasted until November 11, 1918. Differences in foreign policy were to blame, although the immediate cause was the assassination of Austria's Archduke Ferdinand.
The United States declared war on Germany on April 2, 1917. We mobilized 4 million men.
Soldiers fought largely in trenches, and thousands suffered from stress, known as shell shock. The British and French trenches were often squalid, whereas the German trenches were almost luxurious in comparison, with bunks and decent cooking facilities.
The trench network of the Western Front stretched from the English Channel to Switzerland. If laid end to end, the trenches would have extended 25,000 miles.
By the end of World War I, over 9 million soldiers had been killed and another 21 million wounded. Over 1 million soldiers were killed in just one battle, the Battle of the Somme. About 116 Americans were killed in the war, and 234,000 were injured.
Around 11% of the population of France was killed or wounded during the war.
The unofficial Christmas Eve truce of 1914, which we just heard the story of, where German and English soldiers played soccer together, was never repeated. The following Christmas, sentries on both sides were ordered to shoot any soldier who tried this.
World War I was more than just the Western Front, with Germany fighting France and England, and then joined by the United States in 1917. The Germans were also fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front. Also, there was a Siberian campaign fought by Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Bulgaria against the Serbs that took 633,000 lives. Similarly, the Battle of Gallipoli in Turkey, where British, Australian, and New Zealand forces fought the Ottoman Turks, was an extended battle with 473,000 deaths.
Approximately 30 different poisonous gases were used during World War I. At first, soldiers were told to hold a urine-soaked cloth over their faces in an emergency. By 1918, gas masks with filter respirators usually proved effective protection. At the end of the war, many countries signed treaties outlawing chemical weapons.
Veterans Day started as Armistice Day. Armistice Day was the last day of fighting in World War I. The armistice was set for the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, and shots were fired and men killed right up until 11 o'clock on the morning of November 11, 1918.
Before the New Age and the New Frontier and the New Deal, before Roy Rogers and John Wayne and Tom Mix, before Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse and Felix the Cat, before the TVA and the TV and the radio flyer, before the Grapes of Wrath and Gone with the Wind and the jazz singer, before the CIA and the FBI and the WPA, before airlines and airmail and air conditioning, before LBJ and JFK and FDR, before the Space Shuttle and Sputnik and the Hindenburg and the Spirit of St. Louis, before the Greed Decade and the Me Decade and the Summer of Love and the Great Depression and Prohibition, before yuppies and hippies and okies and flappers, before Saigon and Incheon, and Nuremberg and Pearl Harbor, before Martin Luther King and Thurgood Marshall and Jackie Robinson, before the pill and Pampers and penicillin, before the GI surgery and GI Joe and the GI Bill, before AFDC and HUD and welfare and Medicare and Social Security, before superglue and titanium and Lucite, before the Sears Tower and the Twin Towers and the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building, before the In Crowd and the A-Train and the Lost Generation, before the Blue Angels and Rhythm and Blues and Rhapsody in Blue, before Tupperware and the refrigerator and the automatic transmission and the aerosol can and the Band-Aid and nylon and the ballpoint pen, sliced bread, before the Iraq War and the Gulf War and the Cold War and the Vietnam War and the Korean War and the Second World War, there was the First World War. World War I, the Great War, the war to end all wars. That's a poem from The Last of the Doughboys by Richard Rubin.
Thank you, Jamie. You just did a lovely job on that. The war to end all wars. Well, this sermon is about the veterans of World War I. They went into that war as farm boys, but fought with mechanized weapons and came home different people. World War I is history to us now. It's been 101 years since the first shots were fired. The last American World War I veteran, Frank Buckles, died in 2011. He was a venerable 110 years old. Frank Buckles had to go to several recruiting stations in several different states before some recruiter was desperate enough to let him join up. He was small for his age, and he was only 16 years old. But he was determined. He was determined to get into this war. And that was a common story when the U.S. entered World War I. Many young men wanted desperately to join in the fight. We know Frank Buckles' story because Richard Rubin interviewed the very last surviving World War I veterans between 2003 and 2006, not that long ago. Rubin wrote a book about these very old veterans called The Last of the Doughboys, and you just heard a little excerpt from that. There were only a handful of veterans left for him to interview, and now, 9 years later, there are none. There are none. Rubin, the author, interviewed these veterans with such care. It reads like a spiritual practice. He felt driven to hear their stories because when he started, they were all, every single one was over 100 years old. He learned a lot about the very old. He discovered they are almost all hard of hearing and they tend to speak very slowly, so you need to get into their rhythm. These old men and one woman would often remember the past better than they remembered the present. So he got used to, well, reintroducing himself if he came to visit them more than once. He developed patience and he learned to take his time and the stories would come. Sometimes they would come more than once and he got used to hearing the story repeated, especially if it was a good story. So when Rubin was interviewing, he was in this heightened state of awareness and completely in the moment. He knew this was his chance. These very old people might not be there if he waited even a week. He would set up a recorder and then he would listen with all his senses and ask questions. Anthony Piero was 107 years old when Rubin interviewed him. While in France, Piero used to duck under a particular tree when the shells were raining down. Once a shell whistled through his protective tree and got stuck in the branches, but it didn't explode. It was an entirely lucky event, because if it had exploded, it would have been no more Anthony Piero. Piero ran and told his captain about the unexploded shell in the tree, and for some reason the captain said, "Climb up there and get it." And so he did, and he brought the unexploded shell to his captain, and it was then that the captain realized what a dumb thing he had asked Piero to do. And of course, then it was still Piero's job to run it across the field to get it away from the captain. So Reuben, the author, thought this was a pretty good story, and Anthony had a few more like these. He told them cheerfully. World War I seemed like a good time, the way Anthony Piero told this story in his other stories. Sure, an unexploded shell is kind of creepy, but, you know, if this was a war. But in fact, Reuben began to notice that all these very old vets had similar memories. The men, they always remembered some French girl that they had managed to meet. And then they had stories of horses, because horses were big in World War I, and lots of prank stories about scrounging for food, because these were young men, and they were really hungry. They did have these slightly edgier stories, like the bomb in the tree, of odd ways that people had died and odd and lucky escapes from death. In all these interviews, they told these stories very evenly, cheerfully even. Reuben, the author, was a little perplexed by this because he actually knew from his research, that Anthony Piero had been in three long and bloody battles in France. He was part of a machine gun battalion, so he wasn't like behind the lines or anything. In the last one, the Meuse Argonne, more than 26,000 American soldiers had died. Reuben was perplexed by this. He didn't think these men were deliberately holding back grimmer stories. But something had happened. Over time, memories, they do have a kind of way of drifting. And they do usually get more pleasant. We make sense of things, sometimes selectively. And people used to be a lot more stoic, tough. These vets had all had the same kind of stresses and strains that we do, and not a lot of acceptable ways to deal with them. No one in 1920 told you to go to a counselor. They told you to look on the bright side, or get a grip, or they passed you a bottle so you could take a swig. And the men he was interviewing were survivors by definition. But World War I veterans didn't all see the war the same way. There is a record of poetry and stories that tell of World War I veterans trying to come to terms with what they experienced in the trenches. Writing was one way to make sense of what they had seen, heard, and breathed into their lungs. World War I produced some great war poetry and important anti-war novels. Not all of it by any means was American. There are many works written by Germans and the British. The novels and poetry that came out of this war were spare and direct, like a punch to the face. Some of these veterans did not blink when looking at the cruelties and nonsense of the war. Ernest Hemingway was in World War I. He went as an ambulance driver. He had tried to sign up, but his eyesight wasn't good enough. He was another young man who just wanted to get into this war. So he found a way through the ambulance corps. He was only 18 years old when he went to Italy. and he was badly wounded almost immediately. He was given a medal for bravery from the Italians. He apparently had saved some Italian soldiers under fire. He also formed a liaison with a nurse in his hospital where he was being treated for his injuries. These experiences of his led to the novel, The Sun Also Rises, which many of you probably read in high school. But it is felt that that's the best World War I novel produced by an American. And he wrote poetry. Here's a poem he wrote about the war. It's called Champs d'Honneur, which means fields of honor. Soldiers never do die well. Crosses mark the places. Wooden crosses where they fell, stuck above their faces. Soldiers pitch and cough and twitch. All the world roars red and black. Soldiers smother in the ditch, choking through the whole attack. So that's only four lines, and it even rhymes, but it packs a punch, doesn't it? That is a poem written from experience. These writers felt that they had been tricked by words like honor and love of country. Rudyard Kipling wrote, "If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied." And they probably had lied. No one had a really good reason for fighting this war, except maybe the French, who had been invaded. Many historians feel that this war was completely avoidable, or at the very least, it could have ended much, much sooner. When leaders then asked their young men to fight, they had to tell them something, so they used words like honor and love of country. They asked them to make the world safe for democracy, and it worked. Those words meant something to these young men. But once these writer soldiers saw the true horror of the war, they could no longer stand the hypocrisy of those who had asked them to fight. Now, back to Reuben the writer, who was interviewing very old veterans. He did finally find a veteran who had taken the raw memories of World War I and never let them soften or disappear. He found George Bryant in a Louisiana nursing home with his wife, who was younger than him at 101. George was 103 years old. And get this, they had been married for 83 years. So I don't know if that's just wrong. He joined the army at 16, another one of these 16-year-olds, again because he'd returned over and over and talked the recruiters into it. He was assigned to the 3rd Division, which got to France in July of 1918, and he fought continuously from July to November, and he was 16 years old. Here is part of Reuben's second interview of him. Reuben the writer asks, "Do you remember the last night of the war?" Reuben thought it was an innocent question, and one he had asked a lot of the other vets. But George Bryant answered it differently. He didn't just have joy at the end of the war, but also sorrow and regret. George told him, and I'm going to be reading from him, but I'm not going to try and do a Louisiana accent. "Yeah, it was a funny thing. The night before, you understand. We shot all our ammunition at them on that night. And during that night, they shot what they had at us. In other words, instead of moving it, we emptied it at each other. I'll always. There was more men unnecessarily killed. I'll always remember that as long as I live. Why? Why kill the last man? What did you gain by killing the last man? Reuben asks, says to him, you knew the war was ending. Yeah, but that is what they did. Reuben keeps prompting George. So you emptied your shells? Yeah. In the morning, we went out to see what damage was done on the outside, because we were hiding in the woods, you see. And we got to the edge of the woods to see what happened. And we got out there and walked along the edge of the woods. And there were dead Americans that took shelter at the edge of the woods. Americans. And that was exactly where the enemy was shooting at, you see. They knew they were going to hide there. There were more American soldiers killed there than I had seen at one time during the war. Because they hid in the wrong place, you see. And the enemy knew they were going to hang there. And at 12 o'clock that night, the enemy opened fire, you see. He swept his hands in front of him. And all at the edge of those woods, there they fired. And there was American soldiers hiding up in those woods there. It was a sad affair. When I went along there and saw these men lying there dying, 6, 7, 8 at the time, and I cried for their parents. Such fine, big, healthy men had to lose their lives. And then George Bryant himself began to cry, overcome with emotion, 86 years after it happened. He cried for men who probably would be dead now, even if they hadn't gone to war. But that didn't matter, because he could see them again, as fresh as he did that day, and it broke his heart all over again. And that was the last day of the war. The guns stopped, according to the armistice, at 11 a.m. precisely. All the soldiers on both sides came out from where they had been hiding. They couldn't believe the quiet. They couldn't believe they could walk around in the open, where Germans and French or English or Americans were close together. They walked over to each other and exchanged souvenirs. Well, it was all a long time ago, but also not so long ago. For until very recently, we could talk to the people who fought in that war. They lived through so much more than World War I. There was the Great Depression, then World War II, then all of recent history. When they looked back on their lives, as we all do, they could see this war in their youth. And none of them could really make any sense of it. Some of them softened it so they could see it in a warm light. Some, like Hemingway, described it with a fierce intensity. And a very few, George Bryant was one, could not forget. He remembered it like it was yesterday.
So now
is the time for meditation. And it seemed like a nice time to do it right after the service. And I'm going to ring this chime 11 times to commemorate that number that became a sacred number after World War I. And I'd love you to hold in your hearts these veterans that gave up so much, and the ones that came back helped build our country. And also, they did it in France. That was where the war was. And as I was driving here today, I was thinking about France, of course, listening to the radio. And so hold them, these contemporary people in your heart, with these old men.
So we quietly come out of our meditation and think about everything that Katie just shared with us. I think it's a good segue to go into a song. So Joanne, come lead us, please. It's hymn number 159.
Please stand as you're able. Again, we'll go through the song and hum it.
Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for dialogue. So as long as I can get this thing to work, I will pass it around. It might not work for us.
Like, you could just come up here and use this microphone if you have a question or an observation.
Your talk got me thinking that this war isn't just 100 years ago. It created the world we live in. And nothing brings that home to me more than I've spent some time researching how France got involved in Syria during World War I. And ultimately, this is the sort of perfect case of the birds coming home from a very, very troubled French involvement in the Middle East.
Is it working now?
So I want to share my daddy with you. So in very rural Mississippi in 1917, my daddy was just about to be 20 years old, and he joined the army. And he went to France on a ship, and he fought in those trenches. And he fought under General Pershing, and it was hand-to-hand combat. I wish I would have brought it today, this little photograph of my daddy standing in his khaki uniform like this, just so proud, so very proud. He was gassed with mustard gas, and he got the Purple Heart, and he came home a war veteran. And according to my mother, who was 16 at the time, and he began courting heavily, he had the fastest horse and buggy in Why Not, Mississippi. My dad was an entrepreneurial spirit kind of fellow. I don't know where I got mine from, but he made a huge impression on my life. He took that bottle regularly when it was offered to him and was a using alcoholic for all of his life until I was about 12 years old when he started having heart problems and stopped drinking. And so for the last part of his life, we were very, very close. He adored me and was just so proud of me. But he was suicidal. He never talked about the war. He would start drinking and he would turn on himself and he would think of, I think what he was thinking of was the war, and I have no idea what he did there except that I know he fought. If it had been today, you know, I'm sure he would have been diagnosed with PTSD and whatever the effects of the war were. My dad died of lung cancer, and when they treated him with mustard gas.
That is very ironic.
I just want to say that my grandfather served in World War I, too. Do you go around?
I was living in Germany in the early part of 1990. I had both my girls in Germany. My ex was a veteran, as was I. And a wall divided that country for a very long time. And living there, I saw peace united when that wall came down. So peace can be found eventually with a lot of time and a lot of patience. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, I jotted down what you said about Rudyard Kipling's quote, you know, if any question, why would I tell them, because our fathers lied. I have some ideas, but I wonder what your thoughts are about what are the lies today that not just our fathers, but what is, you know, what are the things that we're being told that aren't reflecting truth and the truth.
Well, I'm not an expert on these things, but I think the same old lies work. The same old words that sometimes are absolutely true. Sometimes people are fighting for their country, and they're fighting because they have to, and they do it for those reasons. But I think that that's so many people become veterans, go into the armed service because they want to serve. It's a very noble, they have very noble reasons for why they go in. And I think in World War I, it was so stark because there really wasn't any reason for that war. The things that I read, it was as if, you know, everyone kept thinking someone was going to stop it before it got started because there basically was no reason for it. And the Germans and the English fighting together, that story about them doing the soccer thing, because they spoke each other's language. They shared the same religion. There was so much that they shared, and they could figure that out. The soldiers could, and somehow there wasn't enough leadership at the top to stop that war, and it's just a terrible shame.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you for your comments.